temple of his Holy Spirit, then it shall not be reckoned to my shame, as long as I do not consent to betray his property in enemy hands." Kristen's heart began to pound, because this reminded her in a certain way of her encounter with Bentine. It struck her that perhaps this was her sin, that she had not for a moment thought of God or prayed for his help. Then Sister Cecilia read about Saint Didymus. He was a Christian knight, but he had kept his Christianity secret from all except a few friends. He went to the house where the maiden was confined. He gave money to the woman who owned the house, and then he was allowed to go to Theodora. She fled to a corner like a frightened rabbit, but Didymus greeted her as a sister and the bride of his lord, and said that he had come to save her. Then he talked to her for a while, saying, "Shouldn't a brother risk his own life for his sister's honor?" And finally she did as he asked. She exchanged clothes with him and allowed herself to be strapped into his coat of mail. He pulled the helmet down over her eyes and drew the cape closed under her chin. And then he told her to go out with her face hidden, like a youth who was ashamed to be in such a place. Kristen thought about Arna and had the greatest difficulty in holding back her sobs. She stared straight ahead with tear-filled eyes as the nun read the end of the story. How Didymus was led off to the gallows, and Theodora came rushing down from the mountains, threw herself at the executioner's feet, and begged to be allowed to die in his place. Then those two pious people argued about who would be the first to win the crown, and they were both beheaded on the same day. It was the 28th day of April in the year AD 304 in Antioch, as St. Ambrosius has written of it. When they rose from the table, Sister Potencia came over and patted Kristen kindly on the cheek.
"Yes, I can imagine that you are longing for your mother."
Then Kristen's tears began to fall. But the nun pretended not to notice, and she led Kristen to the dormitory where she was going to live. It was in one of the stone buildings along the colonnade. A beautiful room with glass window panes and an enormous fireplace at the far end. Along one wall stood six beds, and along the other were all of the maiden's chests. Kristen wished she would be allowed to sleep with one of the little girls, but Sister Potencia called to a plump, fair-haired, fully grown maiden.
"This is Ingebjörg Philippa's daughter, who will be your bedmate. The two of you should get acquainted."
And then she left. Ingebjörg took Kristen's hand at once and began to talk. She was not very tall and much too fat, especially in her face. Her eyes were tiny because her cheeks were so fat. But her complexion was pure pink and white, and her hair was yellow like gold and so curly that her thick braids twisted and turned like ropes, and little locks were constantly slipping out from under her headband. She immediately began asking Kristen about all sorts of things, but never waited for an answer. Instead, she talked about herself and reeled off all her ancestors in all the branches. They were grand and enormously wealthy people. Ingebjörg was also betrothed to a rich and powerful man, Einar Einarsson of Agnes, but he was much too old and had twice been widowed. It was her greatest sorrow, she said. But Kristen couldn't see that she was taking it particularly hard. Then Ingebjörg talked a little about Simandara. It was strange how carefully she had studied him during that brief moment when they passed each other in the arcade. Then Ingebjörg wanted to look in Kristen's chest, but first she opened her own and showed Kristen all of her gowns. As they were rummaging in the chests, Sister Cecilia came in. She reproached them and told them that was not a proper activity on a Sunday. And then Kristen felt downhearted again. She had never been reprimanded by anyone except her own mother, and it felt odd to be scolded by strangers. Ingebjörg was completely unperturbed. That night, after they had gone to bed, Ingebjörg lay there talking, right up until Kristen fell asleep. Two elderly lay sisters slept in a corner of the room. They were supposed to see to it that the maidens did not remove their shifts at night, for it was against the rules for the girls to undress completely, and that they got up in time for matins at the church.
but otherwise they didn't concern themselves with keeping order in the dormitory, and they pretended not to notice when the maidens lay in bed talking or eating treats they had hidden in their chests. When Kristen awoke the next morning, Ingebjörg was already in the middle of a long story, and Kristen wondered whether she had been talking all night. Chapter 2. The foreign merchants who spent the summer trading in Oslo arrived in the city in the spring, around Holy Cross Day, which was 10 days before the vigil of St. Hallvard. For that celebration, people came in throngs from all the villages from Lake Mjøsa to the Swedish border, so the town was teeming with people during the first weeks of May. It was best to buy goods from the foreigners during that time, before they had sold too many of their wares. Sister Potencia was in charge of the shopping at Nonnesetter, and on the day before the vigil of St. Hallvard, she had promised Ingebjörg and Kristen that they could go along with her into town. But around noon, some of Sister Potencia's kinsmen came to the convent to visit her. She would not be able to go out that day. Then Ingebjörg managed to beg permission for them to go alone, although this was against the rules. As an escort, an old farmer who received a corrody from the cloister was sent along with them. His name was Håkon. By this time, Kristen had been at Nonnesetter for 3 weeks, and in all that time she had not once set foot outside the convent's courtyards and gardens. She was astonished to see how spring-like it had become outside. The small groves of leafy trees out in the fields were shiny green, and the wood anemones were growing as thick as a carpet beneath the lustrous tree trunks. Bright fair-weather clouds came sailing above the islands in the fjord, and the water looked fresh and blue, rippled by small gusts of spring wind. Ingebjörg skipped along, snapping off clusters of leaves from the trees and smelling them, turning to stare at the people they passed, but Håkon reproached her. Was that the proper way for a noble maiden to act, and one who was wearing convent attire at that? The maidens had to take each other by the hand and walk along behind him, quietly and decorously. But Ingebjörg let her eyes wander and her mouth chatter all the same, since Håkon was slightly deaf. Kristen now wore the garb of a young sister, an undyed pale gray homespun dress, a woolen belt and headband, and a simple dark blue cloak with the hood pulled forward so that her braided hair was completely hidden. Håkon strode along in front of them with a big brass-knobbed stick in his hand. He was dressed in a long black coat with an on-use day made of lead hanging on his chest and a picture of St. Christopher on his hat. His white hair and beard were so well brushed that they glinted like silver in the sun. The upper part of the town, from the Nun's Creek and down toward the Bishop's Citadel, was a quiet neighborhood. There were no market stalls or hostelries, only farms belonging mostly to gentry from the outlying villages. The buildings faced the street with dark and windowless timbered gables. But on this day, the lane was already crowded up there, and servants were hanging over the farm fences, talking to people walking past. As they came out near the Bishop's Citadel, they joined a great throng at the marketplace in front of Hallvard's Cathedral and Olav's Cloister. Booths had been set up on the grassy slope, and there were strolling players who were making trained dogs jump through barrel hoops. But Håkon wouldn't let the maidens stop to watch, nor would he allow Kristen to enter the church. He said it would be more fun for her to see it on the great festival day itself. On the road in front of Clement's church, Håkon took them both by the hand, for here the crowd was even bigger, with people coming in from the wharves or from the lanes between the town yards. The girls were going to Mikkelgard, where the shoemakers worked. Ingebjörg thought the dresses that Kristen had brought from home were pretty and nice, but she said that the footwear Kristen had with her from the village could not be worn on fine occasions. And when Kristen saw the foreign-made shoes, of which Ingebjörg had many pairs, she thought she could not rest until she had bought some for herself. Mikkelgard was one of the largest town yards in Oslo. It extended all the way from the wharves up toward Shoemaker Lane, with more than 40 buildings surrounding 2 big courtyards. Now booths with homespun canopies had also been set up in the courtyards, and above the tents towered a statue of St. Crispin.
There was a great crush of people shopping. Women were running back and forth to the cookhouses with pots and buckets. Children were getting tangled up in people's feet. Horses were being led in and out of the stables, and servants were carrying loads in and out of the storage sheds. Up on the galleries of the lofts where the finest wares were sold, the shoemakers and hawkers in the booths called to the maidens below, dangling toward them small, colorful, gold-stitched shoes. But Ingebjörg headed for the loft, where shoemaker Didrik had his workshop. He was German but had a Norwegian wife and owned a building in Mikkelgard. The old man was conducting business with a gentleman wearing a traveling cape and a sword at his belt, but Ingebjörg stepped forward boldly, bowed, and said,
"Good sir, won't you allow us to speak with Didrik first? We must be back home at our convent before Vespers, and you perhaps have more time?"
The gentleman greeted her and stepped aside. Didrik gave Ingebjörg a poke with his elbow and asked her with a laugh whether they were dancing so much at the cloister that she had already worn out all the shoes she had bought the year before. Ingebjörg gave him a poke back and said that they were hardly used at all, good heavens, but here was another maiden, and she pulled Kristen over to him. Then Didrik and his apprentice brought a chest out to the gallery, and he started taking out the shoes, each pair more beautiful than the last. Kristen sat down on a box, and he tried the shoes on her feet. There were white shoes, and brown and red and green and blue shoes, shoes with painted heels made of wood, and shoes with no heels at all, shoes with buckles, shoes with silken ties, and shoes made from two or three different colored leathers. Kristen almost thought she liked them all, but they were so expensive that she was shocked. Not a single pair cost less than a cow back home. Her father had given her a purse with one mark of silver counted out in coins when he left. This was to be her spending money, and Kristen had thought it a great sum. But she could see that Ingebjörg didn't think she could buy much with it at all. Ingebjörg also had to try on shoes, just for fun. "It didn't cost anything," said Didrik with a laugh. She bought a pair of leaf-green shoes with red heels, but she had to take them on credit. Didrik knew her, after all, as well as her family. But Kristen could see that Didrik did not much care for this, and he was also dismayed because the tall gentleman in the traveling cape had left the loft. They had spent a long time trying on shoes. So Kristen chose a pair of shoes without heels, made of thin blue-violet leather. They were stitched with silver and rose-colored stones, but she didn't like the green silk straps. Then Didrik said that he could change them, and he took them along to a room at the back of the loft. There he had boxes of silk ribbons and small silver buckles, things which shoemakers were actually not allowed to sell, and many of the ribbons were too wide and the buckles too big for shoes anyway. Both Kristen and Ingebjörg had to buy a few of these odds and ends, and by the time they had drunk a little sweet wine with Didrik, and he had wrapped up their purchases in a homespun cloth, it had grown quite late, and Kristen's purse had grown much lighter. When they came out onto East Lane again, the sun was quite gold, and the dust from all the traffic in the town hung like a faint haze over the street. It was so warm and lovely, and people were arriving from Eikeberg with great armfuls of new foliage to decorate their houses for the holiday. Then Ingebjörg decided that they should walk out toward Geita Bridge. On market days, there was always so much entertainment going on in the paddocks along the river, with jugglers and fiddlers. Ingebjörg had even heard that a whole ship full of foreign animals had arrived, and they were being displayed in cages down on the shore. Håkon had had some German beer at Mikkelgard, and was now quite amenable and in good spirits. So when the maidens took him by the arm and begged so nicely, he relented, and the three of them walked over toward Eikeberg. On the other side of the river, there were only a few small farms scattered across the green slopes between the river and the steep incline. They went past the Minorites' cloister, and Kristen's heart shrank with shame, for she suddenly remembered that she had wanted to offer most of her silver for Arna's soul. But she had not wanted to speak of this to the priest at Nonnesetter. She was afraid of being questioned. She had thought that perhaps she could go out to visit the barefoot friars in the pastures to see whether Brother Edvin had returned. She would have liked so much to meet him.
but she didn't know how properly to approach one of the monks or to broach the topic. And now she had so little money left that she didn't know whether she could afford a mass. Maybe she would have to settle for offering a thick wax candle. Suddenly, they heard a terrible roar from countless voices out at the paddock on the shore. It was as if a storm were passing over the swarm of people gathered down there. And then the whole crowd came rushing up toward them, shrieking and hollering. Everyone was running in wild terror, and several people screamed to Hakon and the maidens that the leopards were loose. They raced back toward the bridge, and they heard people shouting to each other that a cage had tipped over and two leopards had escaped. Someone also mentioned a snake. The closer they came to the bridge, the greater the crowd. A baby fell from a woman's arms right in front of them, and Hakon stood over the little one to protect him. A moment later, Kristin and Ingibjörg caught a glimpse of the old man far off to one side, holding the child in his arms, and then they lost sight of him. At the narrow bridge, the mob surged forward so fiercely that the maidens were forced out into a field. They saw people running along the riverbank. Young men jumped into the water and began to swim, but the older people leaped into the moored boats, which became instantly overloaded. Kristin tried to make Ingibjörg listen to her. She screamed that they should run over to the Minorite's cloister. The gray, cowled monks had come rushing over and were trying to gather the terrified people. Kristin was not as frightened as her friend, and they saw nothing of the wild animals, but Ingibjörg had completely lost her head. The swarms of people surged forward again, and then were driven back from the bridge because a large crowd of men who had gone to the nearest farms to arm themselves was now headed back, some on horseback, some running. When Ingibjörg was almost trampled by a horse, she gave a shriek and took off up the hill toward the forest. Kristin had never imagined that Ingibjörg could run so fast. She was reminded of a hunted boar, and she ran after her so that they wouldn't become separated. They were deep inside the forest before Kristin managed to stop Ingibjörg on a small pathway which seemed to lead down toward the road to Trelleborg. They paused for a moment to catch their breath. Ingibjörg was sniffling and crying, and she said she didn't dare go back alone through the town and all the way out to the convent. Kristin didn't think it a good idea either. With so much commotion in the streets, she thought they should find a house where they might hire a boy to accompany them home. Ingibjörg recalled a bridle path to Trelleborg farther down near the shore, and she was certain that along the path were several houses. So they followed the path downhill. Distressed as they both were, it seemed to them that they walked for a long time before they finally saw a farm in the middle of a field. In the courtyard, they found a group of men sitting at a table beneath some ash trees, drinking. A woman went back and forth, bringing pitchers out to them. She gave the two maidens in convent attire a surprised and annoyed look, and none of the men seemed to want to accompany them when Kristin explained their need. But finally, two young fellows stood up and said they would escort the girls to Nonnesetter if Kristin would pay them an ertug. She could tell from their speech that they weren't Norwegian, but they seemed to be decent men. She thought their demand shamefully exorbitant, but Ingibjörg was scared out of her wits, and she didn't think they should walk home alone so late in the day, so she agreed. No sooner had they come out onto the forest path than the men drew aside and began talking to each other. Kristin was upset by this, but she didn't want to show her apprehension, so she spoke to them calmly, told them about the leopards, and asked them where they were from. She also looked around, pretending that at any minute she expected to meet the servants who had been escorting them. She talked about them as if they were a large group. Gradually, the men said less and less, and she understood very little of their language anyway. After a while, Kristin noticed that they were not headed the way she had come with Ingibjörg. The path led in a different direction, more to the north, and she thought they had already gone much too far. Deep inside her, terror was smoldering, but she dared not let it slip into her thoughts. She felt oddly strengthened having Ingibjörg along. The girl was so foolish that Kristin realized she would have to handle things for both of them. Under her cloak, she pulled out the reliquary cross that her father had given her, clasped her hand around it,
and prayed with all her heart that they might meet up with someone soon, as she tried to gather her courage and pretend that nothing was wrong. A moment later, she saw that the path led out onto a road, and at that spot there was a clearing. The bay and the town lay far below them. The men had led them astray, either willfully or because they were not familiar with the paths. They were high up on the slope and far north of Yaita Bridge, which Kristen could see. The road they had reached seemed to lead in that direction. Then she stopped, took out her purse, and began to count out the 10 penninger into her hand.
"Now, good sirs," she said, "we no longer need your escort. We know the way from here. We give you thanks for your trouble, and here is your payment as we agreed. God be with you, good friends."
The men looked at each other for a moment, quite foolishly, so that Kristen was almost about to smile. But then one of them said with an ugly leer that the road down to the bridge was a desolate one. It would not be advisable for them to go alone.
"No one would be so malicious or so stupid as to want to stop two maidens, especially two dressed in convent attire," replied Kristen. "We prefer to go alone."
And then she handed them the money. The man grabbed hold of her wrist, stuck his face close to hers, and said something about a kuss and a beutel. Kristen understood that they would be allowed to go unharmed if she would give him a kiss and her purse. She remembered Bentine's face close to hers, just like this, and for a moment fear seized her. She felt nauseated and sick. But she pressed her lips together, calling upon God and the Virgin Mary in her heart, and at that moment she heard hoofbeats on the path coming from the north. Then she struck the man in the face with her coin purse so that he stumbled, and she shoved him in the chest so that he toppled off the path and tumbled down into the woods. The other German grabbed her from behind, tore the purse out of her hand, and tugged at the chain around her neck, breaking it. She was just about to fall, but she seized hold of the man, attempting to get her cross back. He tried to pull away. The robber had now heard someone approaching too. Ingeborg screamed loudly, and the horsemen on the path came racing as fast as they could. They emerged from the thickets. There were three of them. Ingeborg ran toward them, shrieking, and they jumped down from their horses. Kristen recognized the gentleman from Didrik's loft. He drew his sword, grabbed the German she was struggling with by the scruff of his neck, and struck him with the flat of the blade. His men ran after the other one, seized him, and beat him with all their might. Kristen leaned against the rock face. Now that it was over, she was shaking. But what she felt most was astonishment that her prayer had been answered so quickly. Then she noticed Ingeborg. The girl had thrown back her hood, letting her cloak fall loosely over her shoulders, and she was arranging her thick blonde braids on her breast. Kristen burst out laughing at the sight. She sank down and had to cling to a tree because she couldn't hold herself up. It was as if she had water instead of marrow in her bones, she felt so weak. She trembled and laughed and cried. The gentleman came over to her and cautiously placed his hand on her shoulder.
"No doubt you have been more frightened than you dared show," he said, and his voice was pleasant and kind. "But now you must get hold of yourself. You acted so bravely while the danger lasted."
Kristen could only nod. He had beautiful, bright eyes, a thin, tan face, and coal-black hair that was cropped short across his forehead and behind his ears. Ingeborg had managed to arrange her hair properly at last. She came over and thanked the stranger with many elegant words. He stood there with his hand on Kristen's shoulder as he spoke to the other maiden.
"We'll take these birds along to town so they can be thrown in the dungeon," he said to his men who were holding the two Germans, who said they belonged to the Rostock ship. "But first, we must escort the maidens back to their convent.
I'm sure you can find some straps to tie them up with."
"Do you mean the maidens, Erlan?" asked one of the men.
They were young, strong, and well-dressed boys, and they were both flushed after the fight. Their master frowned and was about to give a sharp reply, but Kristen put her hand on his sleeve.
"Let them go, kind sir."
She gave a small shudder.
"My sister and I would be most reluctant to have this matter talked about."
The stranger looked down at her,
bit his lip, and nodded as he gazed at her. Then he gave each of the prisoners a blow on the back of the neck with the flat of his blade so that they fell forward. "Get going," he said, giving them a kick, and they took off as fast as they could. The gentleman turned back to the maidens and asked them if they would like to ride. Ingibjörg allowed herself to be lifted up into Erland's saddle, but it turned out that she couldn't stay in it. She slipped down again at once. He gave Kristin a questioning look, and she told them that she was used to riding a man's saddle. He grasped her around the knees and lifted her up. She felt a thrill pass through her, sweet and good, because he held her away from himself so carefully, as if he were afraid to get too close to her. Back home, they had never paid attention if they pressed her too close when they helped her onto her horse. She felt so strangely honored. The knight, as Ingibjörg called him, even though he wore silver spurs, offered the other maiden his hand, and his men leaped onto their horses. Ingibjörg now wanted them to go north, around the town, and along the foot of the Rhian Hills and the Marta outcrop, not through the streets. Her excuse was that Sir Erlon and his men were fully armed, weren't they? The knight replied somberly that the ban against bearing weapons was not so strictly enforced for those who were traveling, or for all the people in town who were now hunting wild beasts. Kristin realized full well that Ingibjörg wanted to take the longest and least traveled road in order to talk more with Erlon.
"This is the second time we have delayed you this evening, sir," said Ingibjörg.
Erlon replied gravely, "It doesn't matter. I'm going no farther than to Gerderu tonight, and it stays light all night long." Kristin was so pleased that he neither teased nor jested, but spoke to her as he would to an equal, or more than that. She thought of Simon. She had never met any other young men of the courtly class. But this man was probably somewhat older than Simon. They made their way down into the valley below the Rhian Hills and up along the stream. The path was narrow, and the young leafy bushes flicked wet, fragrant branches at Kristin. It was a little darker down there, the air was chill, and the foliage was wet with dew along the stream bed. They moved slowly, and the hooves of the horses sounded muffled against the damp, grass-covered path. Kristin swayed in the saddle. Behind her she could hear Ingibjörg talking, and the stranger's dark, calm voice. He didn't say much, answering as if preoccupied, as if he were feeling the same as she was, thought Kristin. She felt so strangely drowsy, but safe and content now that all the events of the day had slipped away. It was like waking up as they emerged from the forest, out onto the slopes below the Marta outcrop. The sun had gone down, and the town and the bay lay below them in clear, pallid light. The ochre ridges were limned with bright yellow beneath the pale blue sky. Sounds carried a long way in the quiet of the evening, as if they were coming from the depths of the cool air. From somewhere along the road came the screech of a wagon wheel, and dogs barked to each other from farms on opposite sides of the town. But in the forest behind them, birds chirped and sang at the top of their voices now that the sun had gone down. Smoke drifted through the air as dry grass and leaves were burned, and in the middle of a field a bonfire flared red. The great fiery rose made the clarity of the night seem dim. They were riding between the fences of the convent's fields when the stranger spoke to Ingibjörg again. He asked her what she thought would be best. Should he escort her to the door and ask to speak with Fru Groa, so that he could tell her how this had all come about? But Ingibjörg thought they should sneak in through the church. Then they might be able to slip into the convent without being noticed. They had been gone much too long. Perhaps Sister Potencia had forgotten them because of the visit from her kinsmen. It didn't occur to Kristin to wonder why it was so quiet in the square in front of the west entrance of the church. Usually there was a great hubbub in the evening as people from the neighboring area came to the nuns' church, and all around stood houses where many of the lay servants and Corodians lived. This was where they said farewell to Erlon. Kristin paused to pet his horse. It was black,
with a handsome head and gentle eyes. She thought it looked like Morvan, the horse she had ridden back home when she was a child.
"What's the name of your horse, sir?"
she asked as the animal turned his head and snuffled at the man's chest.
"Bayard," he said, looking at Kristen over the horse's neck. "You ask the name of my horse, but not mine."
"I would indeed like to know your name, sir," she replied, with a little bow.
"Erlan Nikolason is my name," he said.
"Then we must thank you, Erlan Nikolason, for your good assistance tonight," replied Kristen, giving him her hand.
Suddenly, her face flushed bright red. She pulled her hand halfway out of his grasp.
"Fru Ashil Gautisdottir at Dovre? Is she your kinswoman?" she asked.
She saw with surprise that he too turned blood red. He let go of her hand abruptly and replied,
"She is my mother's sister. It's true that I am Erlan Nikolason of Husaby."
He gave Kristen such a strange look that she grew even more confused, but she pulled herself together.
"I should have thanked you with better words, Erlan Nikolason, but I don't know what to say to you."
Then he bowed, and she thought she should say goodbye, even though she would have preferred to talk with him longer. At the entrance to the church, she turned around, and when she saw that Erlan was still standing next to his horse, she raised her hand and waved. Inside the convent, great fear and commotion reigned. Håkon had sent a messenger home on horseback while he himself walked through the town searching for the maidens, and servants had been sent out to help him. The nuns had heard that the wild animals had supposedly killed and devoured two children in town. This turned out to be a rumor, and the leopard, there was only one, had been captured well before Vespers by several men from the king's castle. Kristen stood with her head bowed and kept silent as the abbess and Sister Potencia vented their anger on the maidens. She seemed to be asleep inside. Ingebjörg wept and spoke in their defense. They had gone out with Sister Potencia's permission, after all, with the proper escort, and they were not to blame for what had happened afterward. But Fru Groa told them to stay in the church until the clock struck midnight and try to turn their thoughts to spiritual matters and thank God, who had saved their lives and honor.
"God has clearly shown you the truth about the world," she said. "Wild beasts and the devil's servants threaten his children every step of the way, and there is no salvation unless you cleave to him with entreaties and prayers."
She gave each of them a lit candle and told them to go with Sister Cecilia Bard's daughter, who often sat in the church alone, praying into the night. Kristen placed her candle on the altar of St. Laurentius and knelt down on the prayer bench. She stared steadily into the flame as she said her Pater Noster and Ave Maria. Gradually, the glow of the taper seemed to envelop her, shutting out everything else surrounding her and the candle. She felt her heart open up, brimming over with gratitude and promises and love for God and his gentle mother. She felt them so near. She had always known that they saw her, but on this night she felt that it was so. She saw the world as if in a vision, a dark room into which a beam of sunlight fell, with dust motes tumbling in and out, from darkness to light, and she felt that now she had finally moved into the sunbeam. She thought she would gladly have stayed in the quiet, night-dark church forever, with the few tiny specks of light like golden stars in the night, the sweet fragrance of old incense, and the warm smell of burning wax, with herself resting inside her own star. This sense of joy seemed to vanish when Sister Cecilia silently approached and touched her shoulder. Curtsying before the altar, the three women slipped out of the small south entrance into the convent courtyard. Ingebjörg was so sleepy that she got into bed without talking. Kristen was relieved. She was reluctant to be disturbed, now that she was thinking so clearly. And she was glad they had to keep their shifts on at night. Ingebjörg was so fat and sweated heavily. Kristen lay awake for a long time, but the deep current of sweetness which had borne her as she knelt in the church would not return. And yet she still felt its warmth inside her. She fervently thanked God, and she sensed a feeling of strength in her spirit as she prayed for her parents and her sisters, and for the soul of Arne Geirdsen. Father, she thought. She felt such a longing for him, for all they had had together before Simon Dare had entered their lives. A new tenderness for Lavrans welled up inside her, as if there were a presentiment of maternal love and maternal sorrows in her love for her father that night. She was dimly aware that there was much in life that he had not received. She thought of the old black wooden church at Gerderu, where at Eastertide she had seen the graves of her three little brothers and her grandmother, her father's own mother, Kristen Sigurd's daughter, who had died as she gave birth to him. What could Erlon Nicolason be doing at Gerderud? She could not fathom it. She wasn't conscious of giving any more thought to him that night, but the whole time the memory of his thin, dark face and his quiet voice had hovered somewhere in the shadows, just beyond the radiance of her soul. When Kristen woke up the next morning, the sun was shining in the dormitory, and Ingeborg told her that Fru Groa herself had sent word to the lay sisters that they should not be awakened for matins. They had permission to go over to the cookhouse now to have some food. Kristen felt warm with joy at the kindness of the abbess. It was as if the whole world had been good to her. Chapter 3 The Farmers' Guild at Acker was dedicated to St. Margareta, and every year began its meeting on the 20th of July, which was St. Margareta's Day. On that day, the brothers and sisters would gather with their children, guests, and servants at Acker Church to attend Mass at the St. Margareta altar. Afterward, they would go to the Guild Hall, which stood near Hofvin Hospice. There they would drink for 5 days. But because both Acker Church and Hofvin Hospice belonged to Nonnesetter, and since many of the Acker peasants were tenant farmers of the convent, the custom had arisen for the abbess and several of the eldest sisters to honor the guild by attending the celebrations on the first day, and the young maidens of the convent who were there to be educated but who were not going to enter the order were allowed to go along and dance in the evening, and for this celebration they would wear their own clothes and not their convent attire. So there was a great commotion in the young novices' dormitory on the evening before St. Margareta's Day. Those maidens who were to attend the banquet rummaged through their chests and laid out their finery, while the others looked on and moped. Some of the girls had set small pots on the hearth and were boiling water to make their skin soft and white. Others were brewing something that they rubbed in their hair. Afterward, when they had wound strands of their hair tightly around leather straps, they would have wavy and curly tresses. Ingeborg took out all that she owned of finery, but she couldn't decide what to wear. Not her best leaf-green velvet dress, anyway. It was too costly and too elegant to wear to such a farmer's guild. But a thin little maiden who was not going along, Helga was her name, and she had been given to the convent as a child, pulled Kristen aside and whispered that Ingeborg would of course wear the green dress and her pink silk shift.
You've always been kind to me, Kristen, said Helga. It's most improper for me to get involved in such things, but I'm going to tell you anyway. The knight who escorted you home on that evening in the spring, I have both seen and heard that Ingeborg has talked to him since then. They have spoken to each other in church, and he has waited for her up along the fenced road when she goes to visit Ingen at the Corodian's house. But it's you that he asks for, and Ingeborg has promised to bring you out there with her. I'll wager that you've never heard about this before, have you?
It's true that Ingeborg has never mentioned this to me, said Kristen. She pursed her lips so the other maiden wouldn't see the smile that threatened to appear. So that's the kind of girl Ingeborg was.
I expect she realizes that I'm not the type to run off to meetings with strange men behind house corners and fences, she said haughtily. Then I could have spared myself the trouble to tell you this news, since it would have been more proper for me not to mention it,
said Helga, offended, and the two parted. But all evening, Kristen had to try not to smile whenever anyone looked at her. The next day, Ingebjerg dawdled for a long time, wearing only her shift. Kristen finally realized that the other maiden was not going to get dressed until she herself was done. Kristen didn't say a word, but she laughed as she went over to her chest and took out her golden yellow silk shift. She had never worn it before, and it felt so soft and cool as it slid over her body. It was beautifully trimmed with silver and blue and brown silk at the neck and across the part of the bodice that would be visible above the neckline of her dress. There were also matching sleeves. She pulled on her linen stockings and tied the ribbons of the dainty blue-violet shoes, which Håkon had fortunately managed to bring home on that tumultuous day. Ingebjerg looked at her. Then Kristen laughed and said, "My father has always taught me that we should not show contempt for our inferiors, but you are no doubt so grand that you won't want to dress up for peasants and tenant farmers." Her face as red as a berry, Ingebjerg dropped the woolen shift from her white hips and put on the pink silk one. Kristen slipped her best velvet dress over her head. It was violet blue and cut deep across the bodice, with slit sleeves and cuffs that trailed almost to the ground. She wrapped the gilded belt around her waist and slung her gray squirrel cloak over her shoulders. Then she spread out her thick blonde hair over her shoulders and placed the circlet studded with roses on her forehead. She noticed that Helga was watching them. Then she took from her chest a large silver clasp. It was the one she had worn on her cloak the night that Bentheim had confronted her on the road, and she had never wanted to wear it since. She went over to Helga and said softly, "I realize that you meant to show me kindness yesterday. You must believe I know that." And she handed the clasp to Helga. Ingebjerg was also quite beautiful when she had finished dressing, wearing her green gown with a red silk cloak over her shoulders and her pretty, curly hair falling loose. They had been in a race to outdress each other, thought Kristen, and laughed. The morning was cool and fresh with dew when the procession wound its way from Nonnesetter, heading west toward Frisia. The haying season was almost over in that area, but along the fences grew clusters of bluebells and golden Maria grass. The barley in the fields had sprouted spikes and rippled pale silver with a sheen of faint rose. In many places where the path was narrow and led through the fields, the grain brushed against people's knees. Håkon walked in front, carrying the convent's banner with the image of the Virgin Mary on blue silk cloth. Behind him walked the servants and Carodians, and then came Fru Groa and four old nuns on horseback, followed by the young maidens on foot. Their colorful, secular feast attire shimmered and fluttered in the sun. Several Carodian women and a few armed men brought up the rear of the procession. They sang as they walked across the bright meadows, and whenever they met others on the side roads, the people would step aside and greet them respectfully. All across the fields, small groups of people were walking and riding, heading toward the church from every house and farm. In a little while, they heard behind them hymns sung by deep male voices, and they saw the cloister banner from Hoveder rise up over a hill. The red silk cloth gleamed in the sun, bobbing and swaying with the footsteps of the man who was bearing it. The mighty, sonorous voice of the bells drowned out the neighs and whinnies of the stallions as they came over the last hill to the church. Kristen had never seen so many horses at one time. A surging, restless sea of glossy equine backs surrounded the green in front of the entrance to the church. People dressed for the celebration were standing, sitting, and lying on the slope, but everyone stood up in greeting when the Maria banner from Nonnesetter was carried in amongst them, and they all bowed deeply to Fru Groa. It looked as if more people had come than the church could hold, but an open space closest to the altar had been reserved for the people from the convent. A moment later, the Cistercian monks from Hoveder came in and went up to the choir, and then song resounded throughout the church from the throats of men and boys. During the Mass, when everyone had risen, Kristen caught sight of Erland Nikolausen. He was tall, and his head towered above those around him. She saw his face from the side. He had a high, narrow forehead and a large, straight nose. It jutted out like a triangle from his face and was strangely thin, with fine, quivering nostrils. There was something about it that reminded Kristen of a skittish, frightened stallion. He was not as handsome as she thought she had remembered him. The lines in his face seemed to extend so long and somberly down to his soft, small, attractive mouth. Oh yes, he was handsome after all. He turned his head and saw her. She didn't know how long they continued to stare into each other's eyes. Then her only thought was for the Mass to be over. She waited expectantly to see what would happen next. As everyone began to leave the crowded church, there was a great crush. Ingebjörg pulled Kristen along with her, backward into the throng. They were easily separated from the nuns, who were the first to leave. The girls were among the last to approach the altar with their offering and then exit from the church. Erlan was standing outside, right next to the door, between the priest from Gerderu and a stout, red-faced man wearing a magnificent blue velvet surcoat. Erlan was dressed in silk, but in dark colors, a long brown and black patterned surcoat, and a black cape interwoven with little yellow falcons. They greeted each other and walked across the slope toward the spot where the men's horses were tethered. As they exchanged words about the weather, the beautiful Mass, and the great crowd of people in attendance, the fat, ruddy-faced gentleman, he wore golden spurs, and his name was Sir Munan Bardson, offered his hand to Ingebjörg. He seemed to find the maiden exceedingly attractive. Erlan and Kristen fell behind. They walked along in silence. There was a great hubbub on the church hill as people began to ride off. Horses jostled past each other, and people shouted, some of them angry, some of them laughing. Many of them rode in pairs, men with their wives behind them or children in front on the saddle, and young boys leaped up to ride with a friend. They could already see the church banners, the nuns, and the priest far below them. Sir Munan rode past. Ingebjörg was sitting in front of him, in his arms. They both shouted and waved. Then Erlan said, "My men are both here with me. They could take one of the horses and you could have Hoftor's, if you would prefer that." Kristen blushed as she replied, "We're so far behind the others already. And I don't see your men, so..." Then she laughed, and Erlan smiled. He leaped into the saddle and helped her up behind him. At home, Kristen often sat sideways behind her father after she grew too old to sit astride the horse's loins. And yet, she felt a little shy and uncertain as she placed one of her hands over Erlan's shoulder. With the other hand, she supported herself against the horse's back. Slowly they rode down toward the bridge. After a while, Kristen felt that she ought to speak, since he did not, and she said,
"It was unexpected, sir, to meet you here today."
"Was it unexpected?"
asked Erlan, turning his head around toward her.
"Hasn't Ingebjörg Philippa's daughter brought you my greeting?"
"No," said Kristen. "I haven't heard of any greeting. She has never mentioned you since that day when you came to our aid back in May," she said slyly. She wanted Ingebjörg's duplicity to come to light.
Erlan didn't turn around, but she could hear in his voice that he was smiling when he spoke again.
"And what about the little black-haired one, the novitiate? I can't remember her name. I even paid her a messenger's fee to give you my greetings."
Kristen blushed, but then she had to laugh.
"Yes, I suppose I owe it to Helga to tell you that she earned her pay," she said.
Erlan moved his head slightly, and his neck came close to her hand. Kristen shifted her hand at once to a place farther out on his shoulder. Rather uneasy, she thought that perhaps she had shown greater boldness than was proper, since she had come to this feast after a man had, in a sense, arranged to meet her there.
After a moment, Erlon asked, "Will you dance with me tonight, Kristen?"
"I don't know, sir," replied the maiden.
"Perhaps you think it might not be proper?" he asked. When she didn't answer, he went on, "It could be that it's not. But I thought perhaps you might not think it would do any harm if you took my hand tonight. And by the way, it has been 8 years since I took part in a dance."
"Why is that, sir?" asked Kristen. "Is it because you were married?"
But then it occurred to her that if he were a married man, it would not have been seemly for him to arrange this rendezvous with her. So she corrected herself and said,
"Perhaps you have lost your betrothed or your wife?"
Erlon turned around abruptly and gave her a peculiar look. "Me? Hasn't Fru Ashil?" After a moment, he asked, "Why did you blush when you heard who I was that evening?"
Kristen blushed again but did not reply.
Then Erlon went on, "I would like to know what my aunt has told you about me."
"Nothing more than that she praised you," said Kristen hastily. "She said you were handsome and so high-born that... She said that compared to a lineage such as yours and hers, we were of little consequence, my ancestors and I."
"Is she still talking about such things there, where she now resides?" said Erlon with a bitter laugh. "Well, well, if it comforts her. And she has said nothing else about me?"
"What else would she say?" asked Kristen. She didn't know why she felt so strange and anxious.
"Oh, she might have said," replied Erlon in a low voice, his head bowed. "She might have said that I had been excommunicated and had to pay dearly for peace and reconciliation."
Kristen said nothing for a long time. Then she said quietly, "I've heard it said that there are many men who are not masters of their fortunes. I've seen so little of the world. But I would never believe of you, Erlon, that it was for any ignoble matter."
"God bless you for such words, Kristen," said Erlon. He bent his head and kissed her wrist so fervently that the horse gave a start beneath him. When the animal was once again walking calmly, he said with great ardor, "Won't you dance with me tonight, Kristen? Later I'll tell you everything about my circumstances. But tonight, let's be happy together."
Kristen agreed, and they rode for a while in silence. But a short time later, Erlon began asking about Fru Ashil, and Kristen told him everything she knew. She had much praise for her.
"Then all doors are not closed to Björn and Ashil?" asked Erlon.
Kristen replied that they were well-liked, and that her father and many others thought that most of what had been said of the couple was untrue.
"What did you think of my kinsman, Munan Bardson?" asked Erlon with a chuckle.
"I didn't pay much heed to him," said Kristen, "and it didn't seem to me that he was much worth looking at anyway."
"Didn't you know that he's her son?" asked Erlon.
"Fru Ashil's son?" said Kristen in astonishment.
"Yes. The children couldn't take their mother's fair looks, since they took everything else," said Erlon.
"I didn't even know the name of her first husband," said Kristen.
"They were two brothers who married two sisters," said Erlon, "Bard and Nikolaus Munansson. My father was the older one. Mother was his second wife, but he had no children by his first wife. Bard, who married Ashil, wasn't a young man either, and apparently they never got on well. I was a child when it all happened, and they kept as much from me as they could. But she left the country with Herr Björn and married him without the counsel of her kinsmen, after Bard was dead. Then people wanted to annul their marriage. They claimed that Björn had slept with her while her first husband was still alive, and that they conspired together to get rid of my father's brother. But they couldn't find any proof of this, and they had to let the marriage stand. But they had to give up all their possessions. Björn had killed their nephew, too. The nephew of my mother and Ashil, I mean."
Kristen's heart was pounding. At home, her parents had taken strict precautions to keep the children from hearing impure talk. But things had occurred in their village, too, that Kristen had heard about. A man who lived in concubinage with a married woman,
That was adultery, one of the worst of sins. They were also to blame for the husband's violent death, and it was a case for excommunication and banishment. Lavrans had said that no woman had to stay with her husband if he had been with another man's wife. And the lot of offspring from adultery could never be improved, even if the parents were later free to marry. A man could pass on his inheritance and name to his child by a prostitute or a wandering beggar woman, but not to his child from adultery, not even if the mother was the wife of a knight. Kristen thought about the dislike she had always felt toward Herr Bjørn, with his pallid face and his slack, corpulent body. She couldn't understand how Fru Asiel could always be so kind and amenable toward the man who had lured her into such shame. To think that such a gracious woman could have allowed herself to be fooled by him. He was not even nice to her. He let her toil with all the work on the farm. Bjørn did nothing but drink ale. And yet Asiel was always so gentle and tender when she spoke to her husband. Kristen wondered whether her father knew about this, since he had invited Herr Bjørn into their house. Now that she thought about it, it seemed odd to her that Erlon would speak in this manner of his close kinsman. But he probably thought that she knew about it already. "It would please me," said Erlon after a moment, "to visit her, my Aunt Asiel, sometime, when I journey north. But is he still a handsome man, my kinsman Bjørn?"
"No," said Kristen. "He looks like a mound of hay that has lain on the ground all winter long."
"Ah, yes. It must wear on a man," said Erlon with the same bitter smile. "Never have I seen a more handsome man. That was 20 years ago, and I was only a small boy back then. But I have never seen his equal."
A short time later, they reached the hospice. It was an enormous and grand estate with many buildings of both stone and wood, a hospital, an almshouse, a guest inn for travelers, the chapel, and the rectory. There was a great tumult in the courtyard, for food was being prepared for the banquet in the hospice's cookhouse, and the poor and the sick guild members were also to be served the very best on that day. The guild hall was beyond the gardens of the hospice, and people were heading that way through the herb garden, for it was quite famous. Fru Groa had brought in plants that no one in Norway had ever heard of before, and, besides that, all the plants that usually grew in such gardens seemed to thrive better in hers. Flowers and cooking herbs and medicinal herbs. She was the most skilled woman in all such matters, and she had even translated herbals from Salerno into the Norwegian language. Fru Groa had been particularly friendly toward Kristen ever since she noticed that the maiden knew something of the art of herbs and wanted to know more about it. So Kristen pointed out to Erlon what plants were growing in the beds on both sides of the green lane as they walked. In the noonday sun, there was a hot, spicy fragrance of dill and celery, onions and roses, southern wood and wallflowers. Beyond the shadeless, sun-baked herb garden, the rows of fruit trees looked enticingly cool. Red cherries gleamed in the dark foliage, and apple trees bowed their branches, weighted down by green fruit. Surrounding the garden was a hedge of sweetbriar. There were still some roses left. They looked no different from the other hedge roses, but the petals smelled of wine and apples in the heat of the sun. People broke off twigs and pinned them to their clothing as they passed. Kristen picked several roses, too, tucking them into the circlet at her temples. She held one in her hand, and after a moment, Erlon took it from her, without saying a word. He carried it for a while, and then stuck it into the filigree brooch on his chest. He looked self-conscious and embarrassed, and did it so clumsily that he scratched his fingers and drew blood. In the banquet loft, several wide tables had been set up, one for the men and one for the women along the walls. In the middle of the floor, there were two tables where the children and the young people sat together. At the women's table, Fru Groa sat in the high seat. The nuns and most of the wives of high standing sat along the wall, and the unmarried women sat on the opposite bench, with the maidens from Nonnesetter closest to the head of the table. Kristen knew that Erlon was looking at her,
but she didn't dare turn her head even once, either when they were standing or after they sat down. Not until they rose and the priest began to read the